I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. Bellman, concierge, housekeeper, valet. If the Pullman porter's job was complex, his place in the American consciousness is even harder to pin down. Was he the world's most perfect servant, as Pullman's advertising boasted, or a symbol of racial oppression, icon of gracious travel, or underpaid victim? And what of his contributions to the modern civil rights movement? Today, a conversation with the editor of Railroad History Journal about how more than 40 years after the Pullman Company went out of business, attitudes about its frontline employees reflect our continued ambivalence. It's Up to Date, following this hour's news. The following is an encore broadcast of Up to Date. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. For nearly a century, Pullman porters worked the railroads on sleeping cars as bellmen, housekeepers, and valets. Though the pay was low, the job was seen as one of the best available for African Americans, and they were highly sought. Pullman porters were seen as the world's most perfect servants in advertising, but also as symbols of racial oppression. Today on this Martin Luther King Jr. Day, a look at the Pullman porter. We'll talk about the complex attitudes towards them and how their work helped or hindered the march toward equal rights. Our guest today is Peter Hansen. He's editor of Railroad History, the Journal of the Railway and Locomotive Historical Society. Peter also is a correspondent for Trains, an industry publication. And Peter, welcome back. So good to have you again.
It's great to be here. Thanks, Steve.
Well, Peter, Pullman porters wore a lot of different hats. Remind us what they did.
Yeah, the Pullman porter was really the frontline employee for the Pullman Company. He was the man who made down your berth at night, made it back up again in the morning, cleaned up anything, assisted you in any way. And that could be anything from shining shoes to mailing letters at station stops to pressing your suit. The list went on and on. And if you multiply all of those responsibilities by a typical passenger load of 30 or more people per car, and it was usually one porter to a car, you can appreciate that it was a lot of work and very little sleep.
And so when you got on the train, they were what, the first person you saw?
They were. They would typically be standing at ease outside the vestibule of the car, hands clasped behind their back, and they'd nod at you and greet you. Tell you they'd be with you in a minute or so forth.
And they rode the rails for how long, from when to when?
For just about 100 years. The Pullman Company began hiring African Americans right after emancipation. The Pullman Company went out of business on January 1st, 1969.
How many Pullman porters were there at the height?
There were as many as 12,000 porters at the very height, and that would have been in the 1920s. Passenger rail traffic, overnight rail traffic, peaked in the mid-1920s. And during 1926, I believe it was, the Pullman Company carried an all-time high of over 363 million passengers.
Wow.
Do the math, and it makes for 100,000 people a night. They were by far the world's largest hotelier.
So different time, different era, different way of traveling the country then.
Absolutely, yeah. And, you know, we've sort of lost sight of the overnight rail travel and what a place it had in American life. Business people, of course, in those days did not fly as they do today. They would take overnight trains. And in the 1920s, you could get from New York to Chicago or from Chicago to Denver on an overnight train. It was a run of 16 to 20 hours, depending upon what years we're talking about. And it was a very common experience for not only business people, but also vacationers and so forth.
So Pullman porters, they were all men, Peter?
They were all men, and they were almost all African-American. And we can talk about that at some point. But at one time, the Pullman Company was seeking to break the union and had a brief flirtation with Filipinos. But aside from that, yeah, they were all African-American.
And they worked a lot of hours, too, it sounds like.
They did. They worked a tremendous number of hours because, you know, if you consider all of the responsibilities they had in the passenger load and whatnot, a Pullman porter typically, you know, before they organized into an effective union, a porter typically would only get maybe 3 or 4 hours sleep a night. And even that was not guaranteed. They weren't guaranteed 4 hours sleep a night until after they had won some concessions at the bargaining table. That came later.
But still, it was a job that a lot of men wanted.
It was. It was actually a very prestigious job in the African-American community because when you think about it, it was a job that required some polish and erudition. These men rubbed shoulders in the white world. They regularly catered to the rich and the powerful, politicians, underworld characters, Hollywood types, as well as ordinary traveling business people, baseball players, who generally were not very good passengers.
Because
they tended to tear things up. They'd have pillow fights in the cars at night and they'd just be rowdy and so forth. And they weren't very good tippers either. And the whole subject of tipping and the psychology of tipping and whatnot is a fascinating subject in and of itself.
So it was the extent to which they were sort of subservient that sort of became the controversial point of who they were and what they did.
Yeah, I think that's really true. And I think it's more controversial in recent years than it was while it was actually happening. I think people just accepted during that 100 years or so that African Americans had a certain place in the overall scheme of things and this was their proper place and so forth. I think today there are a lot of folks who don't quite know what to do with the Pullman Porter story, don't quite know where to place them. Were they an exploited minority? Were they underpaid victims? Or were they actually leaders in the community and paragons of the civil rights movement and so forth? I first became interested in this subject, honestly, Steve, because several years ago I was listening to a radio call-in show on a public radio station.
See, we change the world every day.
There
here,
you go.
Peter.
Yeah. A show not unlike this, but it happened to be in Chicago. And there was a guest on the program who was sharing his point of view that the Porters were symbols of servility and that it's a chapter of African American and indeed larger American history that is best forgotten. And I honestly think that misses the point. I think this is an inspiring story and one that every American should be proud of.
Inspiring because?
Inspiring because these men were by the very nature of their jobs dignified, and they used that dignity as a springboard to win concessions at the bargaining table and in the larger civil rights movement. When the Pullman Porters Union won concessions from the company in 1937, it was the first time an organized group of African Americans had ever won anything at the bargaining table.
Wow.
And the head of the union, a gentleman by the name of A. Philip Randolph.
Randolph, sure. Yeah.
Fascinating character. If you will, something of a civil rights impresario. Okay, I won't say that the Pullman Porters were unimportant to them. To him, they certainly were, but they were to him a means to a larger end. He was interested in the overall civil rights struggle, and having won concessions for the Pullman Porters, he moved on from there and became a key figure in getting the defense plants organized in the run up to the or getting the defense plants integrated in the run up to the Second World War. He was instrumental in persuading Harry Truman to integrate the armed forces. And today I think there's probably widespread agreement that the armed forces are probably the most colorblind institution in America.
Well, Martin Luther King Jr. once referred to A. Philip Randolph as a mentor and one of the most important Americans ever.
He did, yeah. And I actually had a quote on that. This was a letter that he had written to Randolph in the wake of the 1963 March on Washington. This is right after I Have a Dream and all the rest. And he wrote to Randolph that, quote, "You are truly the dean of Negro leaders. If I had to choose the 10 greatest persons in America today, I would certainly include you on my list. I don't know if you've ever considered writing an autobiography." He never did. "I certainly hope you will, because what you have done should be written in a memoir for generations yet unborn to read and meditate on." So King definitely got it.
Well, so when you look at the Pullman Porter then, Peter, and this question, this central question we're talking about today, the world's most perfect servants or symbols of racial oppression, you come down where on that?
Honestly, I come down saying that there's a lot of it. There's a lot of everything here.
Yes, right.
Okay. You know, and I always tell people when I give a lecture on this subject that I pardon the expression, this is not a matter of black and white. There are lots of gray areas here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That the Pullman Porter was billed by the company as the world's most perfect servant. Was he? Well, yeah, he probably was. Was he a symbol of racial oppression? Yes, he sometimes was. The company didn't treat him well. Sometimes passengers didn't treat him well. Was he an icon of gracious travel? Almost always. Was he an underpaid victim? He certainly was. Was he dignified? He had to be dignified. It was his job. Was he demeaned frequently? Did he have opportunity? Yes, he did. And so the side that I come down on here is to say that the Pullman Porter may actually have been the world's most perfect symbol of the African-American experience.
Hmm.
It's a complex story. Mm-hmm. There's painful stuff, and there's stuff that's terribly moving and heroic.
Have you had a chance to talk to Pullman Porters yourself over the years? I mean, what do they say about this issue?
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting because there aren't very many of them left, considering that the Pullman Company went out of business 40 years ago. A few of the younger porters stayed on into the Amtrak era.
Huh.
But of course, that was a different workplace, and by then a different era, because you know, we're well into the civil rights era by that time. The interesting thing about the porters is that I get the impression anyhow that a lot of them are like World War II veterans. If you talk to them, that a lot of them in the earlier years didn't really want to talk about it very much. And now there's this sense that the stories might die with us if we don't tell them now.
Hmm. And so they're talking.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
And when you ask them about were they perfect symbols of racial oppression or the perfect servant, what do they say?
You know, it's really hard to put that question point blank,
mm-hmm.
you know. But, you know, the conclusions that I've just related here that I've come to are really drawn from those conversations.
That's interesting.
And so, yeah, I mean, when you read between the lines of the responses that you get when you ask the questions, and some of them actually wrote down their memoirs and so forth, and, you know, they're in various research libraries and whatnot, that when you read between the lines, you find that, yeah, all of that stuff is there.
I think it's hard for some listeners to appreciate just how exacting the standards were for Pullman porters back in those days. I think in your notes you refer to something about if a linen is touched prior to the time the customer begins to use it, that linen has to be discarded for use that day. And again, the quarters that people stayed in cleaner than probably their own homes.
Oh yes, absolutely. And that was something that was, you know, that was rigidly enforced by the Pullman Company. The porters were very well trained, but the company also had spies that were riding the cars all the time, incognito.
Hmm.
The company called them special agents, almost as though they were FBI agents. And in fact, they were undercover. A lot of the porters knew who they were anyhow. And they would have signals by which they would, you know, relate to
each other
on passing trains that there were special agents in the area and so forth. But the standards –
very different than you find on Amtrak today, by the way.
Yeah. And, you know, Amtrak does a reasonably good job. But, you know, that said
– reasonably.
Yeah. The overall standards in travel have declined no matter what mode of transportation we're talking about anymore. We don't expect the same level of service that we used to.
Again, we're talking about the Pullman Porter this morning. Were they symbols of racial oppression or the world's most perfect servants? We're visiting with Peter Hansen. He's editor of Railroad History, who's done a lot of research on this question. Peter, tell us about George Pullman, who hired these men for his Pullman Company. Who was he?
Right. The story does begin with George Pullman. He was born in upstate New York in 1831, and this was a man who was just determined to be rich. And he tried a few different means toward that end, and he was actually successful at a couple of different ventures before he began the Pullman Company. But his earlier ventures, he went prospecting for gold in Colorado, and he literally raised buildings out of the muck in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And so he had a lot of experience traveling overnight trains. And this is in the 1850s, the early 1860s. And suffice to say that overnight travel on the trains before Pullman came along was generally not very good. The conditions mm-hmm. were primitive. The berths were, you know, had wafer-thin mattresses. They were almost exclusively inhabited by traveling men. No decent woman would be seen in one. There were spittoons on the floor and this and that and the other.
Wow.
Most of the guys wouldn't take their boots off before they went to bed and whatnot.
Wow.
Pullman thought that he could do better. And what he did is he created what we would call today a vertically integrated conglomerate, everything from manufacturing the cars to providing the service
Wow.
and the people who worked on them. And it was a great business model for the railroads. They didn't really know how to do hospitality, especially in the early days. Pullman essentially went to them and said, before the term or the concept even existed, said, look, outsource this stuff to me.
Wow.
Okay.
Wow.
I know how to do this, and then you don't have to worry about it. It was a great model for the railroads in other ways as well, because there are seasonal peaks and valleys in rail travel in different parts of the country. In the wintertime, people in the east want to go to Florida. In the summertime, people want to go to the national parks in mm-hmm. the west.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And this way, Pullman could say to the railroads, look, we can decrease your capital investment in your equipment. And we will have this free-running fleet of cars that can go anywhere as needed. It was a great idea.
Wow.
So the railroads bought into it, and Pullman was almost the exclusive provider of sleeping car services for 100 years.
He became a rich man.
He
fulfilled his dream.
He did. He became a very rich man.
Karen from Prairie Village. Karen, good morning. You're on Up to Date.
Good morning. I just wanted to add, I rode when I was 12. I took the Super Chief with my parents
yeah.
from Los Angeles to Chicago, and the porters on there made me feel so special. it's just a wonderful memory of them, and indeed they were dignified. And of course, at that time we weren't thinking about oppression. I just thought that they were wonderful people, and I just wanted to add that.
That's great, Karen. Thank you very much.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and of course, the Super Chief was one of the finest trains in America, and it was a favorite of the Hollywood set. It was a favorite of the Hollywood set and Titans of Industry. If you rode the Super Chief, generally speaking, you were somebody.
Jim Lehrer of PBS was on this show talking about the Super Chief in a novel he wrote just a year or so ago about that famous train. Let's go to Joe from Kansas City, Missouri. Joe, you're on Up to Date with Peter Hansen. Good morning.
Oh, good morning. I just wanted to say that my grandmother fell in love with A. Philip Randolph, and she didn't think she could get him, but she wanted to marry Pullman Porter. One of the things interesting about Kansas City is my understanding that when they were issued the charter or notified that they had been chartered, that news was received here in Kansas City, Missouri, and that during the time, difficult times of the Pullman Porters organizing as a union, they were not supported by all African-American press. But in Kansas City, Franklin, who was the founder and publisher of the Kansas City Call, was a good friend of A. Philip Randolph.
Hmm.
Yes, that is very true. And you're right, Joe, on all counts. There was some division within the African-American press around the country. But the Call was a stalwart supporter of the union. The Amsterdam News in New York was. The Chicago Defender went back and forth. at first they were opposed and later fell into line. And this actually points to one of the things that the Porters did, and that was to disseminate African-American culture around the country.
Mm.
These were traveling men, and so they took the newspapers home to the folks in the South. They would take jazz records. You couldn't get a Bessie Smith record if you were living someplace in rural Georgia, but your Porter friend could bring it home for you or could sell it to you.
Mm-hmm.
They could tell you the stories of the Harlem Renaissance, of a place where African Americans could live virtually among themselves with almost no contact with the white world, where all the businesses and all the professionals were black owned. And it gave a lot of African Americans a vision of a different kind of life. They heard about factory jobs in the North. The Pullman Porters were a key catalyst in the Great Migration, and a key catalyst, I think, in just inspiring the African-American community to think that there might be something better.
Just one thing I'd like to add, and
yeah.
when you mentioned that, when many blacks in the South who wanted to move north, you know, they always asked Pullman porters what were the best cities. And I found that quite interesting.
Oh, that is interesting.
That is an excellent story. I hadn't quite heard that, but I have absolutely no trouble believing it.
Joe, thank you.
Thank you.
An emailer wants to know, is there a good biography of A. Philip Randolph that you would recommend?
Yes, and unfortunately, I don't have my notes. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Send it to us and we'll put it up.
Yeah, absolutely. One thing that does come to mind off the top of my head is there was a very nice book about 10 years ago. It was titled Brotherhoods of Color, and it was written by a university professor by the name of Eric Arneson, A-R-N-E-S-O-N. More recently, there is a book about that's actually titled Railroads and the African-American Experience, written by a professor from San Diego State and published by Johns Hopkins. And it has chapters not only about the Pullman porters, but about all aspects of African-American culture that touch the railroad story.
Mike from Kansas City, Missouri, good morning.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention I used to read Time magazine all the time, and 100 years ago, and they were talking about Philip Randolph. He said Kansas City was the most segregated city that he ever went to, and that he was talking about the blacks having to sit up in the balcony at the theaters and stuff like that.
Mike, thank you. That ring a bell?
I don't have any trouble believing it, and I think it just stems from the fact that historically we were at that fault line between North and South, and it made for some interesting relations between the races.
We were talking about George Pullman, Peter, and there's actually a town named Pullman. It's in Illinois. What's the significance of that town?
Pullman, Illinois was a company town. George Pullman established it as his manufacturing facility, and the workers lived in Pullman housing, and they sent their kids to Pullman schools, and they shopped at the Pullman store, and they worshipped at the Pullman church if they wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of an artifact of paternalistic management, you know, and that sort of thing was fairly common in the late 19th century when Pullman was first built, the town was first built. However, there are some things that suggest that Pullman didn't quite get it when it came to labor relations, and it really came to a head in 1894. The country was going through the worst economic downturn in its history up to that point, and Pullman cut wages by 30% at his factory, but he did not cut the rents. The workers threatened to strike, and in fact did. Eugene Debs, later known as a perennial socialist candidate for president, had something called the American Railway Union at the time. This encompassed workers from all railroad crafts. They went on strike in sympathy with the Pullman workers. Trains that handled Pullman cars just did not move. Eventually, President Cleveland had to call out 12,000 federal troops, and a couple dozen people were killed in the violence that really ensued nationwide. And it was all touched off at Pullman, Illinois.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our good conversation here about Pullman porters. We'll talk more about why so many African Americans were drawn to this job and their daily life as a Pullman porter and what that was like. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. This hour, we're visiting with Peter Hansen. He's editor of Railroad History, the Journal of the Railway and Locomotive Historical Society. We're talking about the Pullman porter and whether he was a symbol of racial oppression or the world's most perfect servant, as they were billed in advertising. Our phone number here again, 816-235-2888. Our email address, uptodate@kcur.org. Well, you know, Peter, why African Americans? Why were they the sort of chosen to be Pullman porters? What's the link there?
Well, if you go back to the time when Pullman was ramping up his company, this is the immediate aftermath of the Civil War. There were actually 4 million freedmen. Many of them had been house servants. A lot of them wanted to escape the South. You know, as house servants, they would have already had the necessary erudition to provide the standard of service that Pullman was interested in.
So it was a natural tie here.
It really was. And then there were more subtle things than that, too. For one thing, the Pullman porter came from a different social class and social strata than his passengers did. You know, we've all seen the movies that have scenes aboard Pullman cars, and people get into compromising situations in the cars. Maybe they forget to tie the drapes closed, and so somebody opens the drapes thinking that it's their berth, and, you know, somebody's in there in their underwear.
Yeah.
You know, drunks stumbled into and out of berths all the time.
Right.
There were dalliances that went on in the Pullman cars, okay? There were a lot of things that you wouldn't want the folks back home to know. And because the porter was African-American, if you were a white passenger, you didn't really have to worry that that stuff would get back to the home folks. So there was that aspect of it. And then there was also the fact that an African-American servant made middle-class white passengers who maybe didn't have house servants of their own, made them feel really important, made them feel really pampered. And so, you know, they'd take their vacation for a week or two every year, and they thought they were living in the lap of luxury.
And so, again, they were drawn to the whole thing for all those reasons. Then.
Yeah, absolutely.
How about A. Philip Randolph when it came to his ties with the modern civil rights movement?
Randolph had been, I think I had said before, something of a civil rights impresario, and his involvement in civil rights actually predated his involvement with the Union. He was a preacher's son from near Jacksonville, Florida, and was born in 1888, if I remember correctly. Had gone north to New York and ran the Messenger, a black newspaper in New York City. In 1925, a group of five Pullman porters were looking to organize a union. And there had been previous attempts at organization, and they had all been mercilessly gunned down, if you will, by the company. And they determined—
Literally gunned down.
No, not literally. But okay. They had just been shot down by, you know, by the company's virulent anti-union stance.
Mm-hmm.
And so they understood, these five porters, that they needed to get someone who was not a porter to head this union. And Randolph, already being known in Harlem in those days, was recruited. He was happy to do it. At the very first meeting of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, he did all the talking. He gave the invocation. He led the Pledge of Allegiance. He sang the national anthem. And he gave a stem-winding speech. He was a stem-winding orator. And so he was a very inspirational figure. When Joe called in a few minutes ago and said that his mother wanted to marry A. Philip Randolph, I'm not surprised, because he was very charismatic. Now, when you fast forward to 1937, the company wins, or the union wins concessions from the company, and Randolph, even though he stays the head of the union, he moves on to other things. In 1940, U.S. hasn't entered the Second World War yet, but war production is already ramping up.
Mm-hmm.
Lend-lease has been passed. We're selling war material to the British, but the defense plants are not integrated. And Randolph gets this notion that they should be, and that if they're not, he's prepared to stage a march on Washington. He thinks he can get 10,000 African Americans
Wow.
to march down Pennsylvania Avenue. And he's very public about that. The president's worried. He sends Eleanor to talk to Randolph. And Eleanor doesn't get him to back down. And so FDR calls Randolph for drinks at the White House one afternoon. And he tries to turn on the charm, and he talks about this and that and the other. And finally, it's Randolph who breaks the ice. And he says, "Mr. President, we both know why I'm here. Are you going to integrate the defense plants or not?" And Roosevelt wasn't about to be bullied. He sent Randolph away with no satisfaction. But a few days later, he issued Executive Order 8802, integrating the defense plants. And significantly, it was only 4 days before the scheduled march on Washington. Now, that was in 1940. Fast forward 23 years.
Man, no kidding.
And that same plan gets dusted off by Randolph and the Brotherhood and becomes the march on Washington that we all know about, with far more than 10,000 people involved.
Why isn't A. Philip Randolph even better known today? I'd heard of him, knew a little bit about him, but why don't we know more about him?
You know, and that's the interesting thing, because in 1963, he had been a civil rights movement or a civil rights leader for more than 40 years, far longer than anyone else in the movement at that point. But, you know, those 40 years mostly took place before the television era. He's there in the films from 1963, from the March in Washington. If you know who to look for, he's there. He introduced Dr. King that day.
Hmm.
It was sort of a passing of the torch, if you will.
Yeah. So he was king before king.
Well, yeah, in a lot of ways he was.
In a lot of ways, not always, yeah.
And, you know, there's another very interesting story that relates through a direct line to Dr. King and starts with A. Philip Randolph. And it comes from 1955, the Montgomery bus boycott. Okay. Martin Luther King is newly arrived in town. He's 26 years old, a callow youth, a little wet behind the ears maybe. Uh-huh. He's pastor of the biggest black Baptist church in Montgomery. And a porter by the name of E.D. Nixon comes to him. He's the head of the local NAACP chapter. He was the one who had actually been looking for someone to be the test case for the Montgomery bus boycott. It was he who latched on to Rosa Parks and said, yes, Rosa, you're our gal. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so Nixon comes to King and he says, Dr. King, we'd like to have you involved in the bus boycott. I think it's very important that a man in your position, head of the biggest black Baptist church in town, is seen to be involved in this. And King kind of demurred. He wasn't sure. He said, you know, I don't know if I should rock the boat at this stage and all of that. And Nixon says, well, you know, Reverend, I understand. He said, I'll tell you what, I need to make some phone calls, but why don't you call me back this afternoon and, you know, think it over and let me know what you come up with. So anyway, that's what happens. King calls Nixon back that afternoon and he said, well, yeah, okay, I'm in. You know, and Nixon says, well, I'm glad to hear you say that, Reverend, because I just called 18 people today and told them we were meeting at your church tonight.
Wow.
You know, what I like about that story is that, you know, it shows that there was a time before Dr. King was Dr. King, okay? A time when he could have gone one way or the other. I don't know that there's really any serious doubt as to which way he would have chosen. But, you know, he needed to have somebody tell him, yeah, do this, do this. And, you know, we all face crossroads in our lives. We all face decisions. King did the right thing then, and he went on to do much greater things.
Peter Hansen is our guest. We're talking about the history of the Pullman Porter on this Martin Luther King Jr. Day. If you have memories of traveling the rails with Pullman porters and being served by them, 816-235-2888 is our number, our email address, update@kcur.org. Chet from Paola. Chet, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
I just wanted to provide an insight on the level of trust that people put in the porters.
Yes.
In 1950, it was the end, beginning of the Korean War, and my folks were, my dad was called up to Washington, D.C., and both my mom and dad got sick and went to the hospital, and I was there alone, and the neighbors got a hold of my grandparents here in Kansas City, and at 6 years old, they took me down to the train station and pinned notes all over my jacket with money in them. And put me in the hands of a porter who took me on the B&O all the way to Chicago, delivered me to a red cap, who delivered me to a cab, who delivered me to a red cap at the Union Pacific Station, who delivered me to a porter who brought me all the way to Kansas City. They took care of me, they paid for my meals, and they delivered me safely to Kansas City, and it was a wonderful trip, and the care that they gave me was absolutely marvelous.
You know, Chet, that is just a great story. What a great story, Peter.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a wonderful story, Chet, and it was not at all uncommon. People did have that level of trust in the Pullman Porter. You knew that.
A great story.
Yeah, you knew that he was trustworthy. That was part of
his
job.
That's right. Absolutely.
And Chet, when you had a meal, would someone sort of take a few bucks out of your pocket of your jacket, or how did it work?
I had an envelope for each one, including tip.
Boy, that's terrific. Thanks so much for calling that in, Chet. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah, bye-bye now. Let's go to Naomi from Kansas City, Missouri. Naomi, can you top that one?
I don't know if I can or not, but perhaps mine is just as interesting.
Sure.
My uncle was a Pullman porter with Missouri Pacific Railroad, and I can recall as a child, I guess about 4 years old, we started to travel. And we always dressed up when we traveled. The Union Station was just bustling with people from all over. And so when we boarded the train, particularly if we were going down south, before we approached the Mason-Dixon line, one of the porters would come through, who was a friend, of course, of my uncle, and he would direct us to the dining car so that we would not have to move to the back of the train as we approached the Mason-Dixon line. And riding in the dining car was like being a VIP. The meals were fantastic. My uncle's friends were like our relatives. We always had contact with people in various cities where we visited, and it was just a wonderful time for me as a child. I look forward to it. My aunt was just such a wonderful traveling companion. How about that? So that's something I wanted to add to it. It was a great time in my life as a child, traveling on the train.
Boy, that's a great phone call, Naomi. Thanks so much for making it. Sure appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye.
Rick from Independence writes, for a vivid nonfiction account of the Pullman Porter's life, I recommend Isabel Wilkerson's The Warmth of Other Suns, the great book that came out just a year or two ago. She's been a guest on this program. One of the men she profiles had been a Pullman Porter, and her account reinforces the complexity of the Pullman Porter's life. She writes of the fascinating and sudden transitions that came about as a result of civil rights legislation and how these transitions changed the legal and psychological landscape in the Jim Crow states. Terrific book.
Yep, absolutely.
Let's move on here, Peter, and talk about a little more of the everyday life of a Pullman Porter. And one thing that struck me about this was the work day would begin before the train would begin moving, obviously, and that portion of a Pullman Porter's day was very much unpaid.
Yes, it definitely was. And a porter would typically report to work 3 or 4 hours before the run began.
3 or 4 hours.
Yeah. And of course, they had to log in, and they also needed to make sure that the car was cleaned. The cars should have been cleaned by the time he got there, and they were invariably cleaned by African American women. Here in Kansas City, there was a Pullman coach yard that was just next to Southwest Boulevard. If you go down Southwest Boulevard around 25th Street, there's an old roundhouse there.
Oh, yeah.
There was a Pullman coach yard adjacent to that, and that's where the cars were cleaned.
Huh.
And that's also where the Pullman porters signed on to work if they were working out of Kansas City. And so they were responsible for any final cleaning of the car if anything had been overlooked. They needed to check out the linens, make a rigorous and accurate count, because they were held responsible for anything that was missing at the end of the run.
So if something was missing, they were docked for it.
They were. Yeah, they absolutely
wow.
were. And during the run, they had a variety of responsibilities, not only the things that we've talked about and the things that everybody knows about, making the beds and so forth, but shining shoes. And the porters bought their own polish. Shining shoes was not a part of the Pullman manual, probably because the company didn't want to pay for the polish. And yet it was probably the most common, what the porters called hustle, for tips.
Mm-hmm.
And tips were very important because in the 1920s, for example, the porters were only paid about $800 a year. They would make, on average, about $600 in tips for the year, which brought their annual pay to around $1,400, or about two-thirds what an average white middle-class worker would make. And so the tips were very, very important. Shining shoes was part of it. If a passenger wanted to have a letter mailed, wanted their suits pressed, wanted to wake passengers, or he had to do wake-up calls. And you were talking, Steve, before about how there were prescribed methods of doing things in the porter's manual. One of them was the way of waking a passenger up. You didn't reach your hand into the berth and shake him on the shoulder. You shook the curtains gently from the outside and called maybe sotto voce, "Sir, it's 2 o'clock. Your stop is in 15 minutes.
Wow.
And ladies were to be assisted at the elbow only, unless they specifically requested otherwise. There were a whole variety of rules like that that the porter had.
Was there a manual?
There was, yeah. And there were a lot of things that the porter was responsible for. And unlike the operating crew of the train, the engineer and fireman and conductor and so forth, who only tended to work 100 or 200 miles at a time, and then they were switched out for a new operating crew, the Pullman porter took the whole run from terminus to terminus. And so if you worked from, say, Chicago to Los Angeles on the Superchief, like the lady we just talked about, the Superchief was on the road for two nights Okay. If you go back 100 years, the fastest trains between those two points were on the road for 4 nights. Okay. And you'd have a night in your away terminal, and then you'd come back again. And so in a week's time, you might have one good night's sleep, and the rest of the time, you maybe got 3 hours sleep a night. It was a tough job.
Man, really tough job. Yeah. So these men were never home.
They were rarely home.
For their kids, and I'm sure there's a consequence, a price to be paid for that, Peter.
Yeah, although oddly enough, the thing that you hear about more than anything else is that, first of all, the porters, most of them were married. And just to kind of digress a little bit here, we were talking about the beginnings of the porters' union and how important it was that a porter couldn't be seen to be part of the union.
Mm-hmm.
It was the porters' wives who collected the union dues, who distributed the union newspaper, who notified everybody of the union meetings and so forth. So the women were right there with this. There was a ladies' auxiliary to the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters.
Mm-hmm.
By some accounts, it is reckoned that the porters, modest though their wages and tips were by the standards of the white middle class, that they actually became the foundation of the black middle class. They were leaders by virtue of the work they did, and they also made better money than most black people did. And there was an entire book written about 10 years ago by a reporter for the Boston Globe. Larry Tye, T-Y-E, and it was called Rising from the Rails. He interviewed a lot of the porters, and his conclusion was that they really were the foundation of the black middle class. They used their savings to send their kids to school. And if you look at civil rights leaders, chances are there's a very good chance that you'll find a Pullman porter in their family tree or someone close to them. Roy Wilkins' uncle was a Pullman porter. Thurgood Marshall worked as a porter during summers in college. Malcolm X was a porter.
Really?
He was a teenager. Yeah. So it was a good job, and it was a respected job.
And they were in charge of cleaning and restocking the car, scouting for lost belongings, and some folks were great tippers, and as you've mentioned, some folks weren't.
It's really interesting. John D. Rockefeller, richest man on earth, his typical tip was a penny.
Why?
I don't know. I guess he had this attitude that I made it myself, and that's the way everybody should make it.
You talk about playing into stereotypes. Yeah. That the richer you are, the worse tipper you are.
Well, but the interesting thing is that his wife followed discreetly behind him and usually tipped the porter a dollar.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And and then political figures were kind of interesting too. And, you know, it cuts both ways. You can't just assume that the Democrats were better tippers than the Republicans because there were exceptions on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
Franklin Roosevelt was a modest tipper. Okay, Eleanor, incidentally, was a very good one.
Why am I not surprised? Yeah.
The president's car was actually operated by the Pullman Company. And the porter who worked that car – and you'll like this story, Steve. The porter who worked that car, when he got a chance, he chose to go and bid on the job in the reporter's car because they were better tippers.
And reporters. It's funny how giving of a tip is this secretive kind of thing. But for famous people, the word always gets out. Are you a good tipper? Are you not a good tipper?
That's very true. And among the porters, public figures had really well established reputations. Here's something, if I may. Let me just share something.
Yeah.
that one porter wrote back in 1931. Okay, so you have to remember the times. It's Prohibition and all of this.
It's prior to the Union here.
Right. Right. It's while the Union is still organizing. And as a matter of fact, 1931, for a variety of reasons, was not a good year for the Union. The Union nearly died at one point. But in any case, this was a porter named Nathaniel Hall. And he said, I've been asked quite often, who are the best passengers and tippers? Well, there's the working class. They work a year to take a vacation. They have itemized every little detail for a 2 weeks trip, and they never forget the porter. Newlyweds are also good. The groom tips fast and heavy, especially in the presence of the bride, and he is always in her presence.
That's right.
Baseball players are the limit. Most of them are vulgar and uncouth. They tear up the linen, destroy the pillows in battles, and many walk out without even saying thanks for the service. Among the most generous tippers of today are the underworld characters. Drunks were also once among the best, but now in this age of rotten liquor and bad beer, they're only good to lose something, a shirt, a suitcase, or a shoe.
Wow.
Isn't that a great story?
Laid it right out there, right? Deanne writes this, after my railroader father had passed away, I as a child was able to ride the trains for a quarter fare. One of my indelible memories of those trips, besides the wonderful treatment by the porters, was the tinkle of the ice and the glasses in the beautiful dining cars as the train swayed along. Thank you for reminding us of this era and all of its implications.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, for people who have eaten aboard a dining car, they will tell you there was nothing like it. The experience was heightened by the fact that you were going someplace in an age when people didn't travel as much as they do today. Mm-hmm. We've gotten kind of blasé about travel, but it was an adventure then.
Donna writes us this, in the 1950s, my dad played for the Pittsburgh Pirates, and we made the 1,500-mile trip from KC to San Bernardino on the train in a sleeping compartment. We always look forward to the porter preparing our compartment for bedtime when the berths were made up for sleeping. The porters helped us from car to car for meals in the dining car. We made the trip often, and some of the porters remembered us and knew our names. As a child, it was a great adventure.
And we know that you were the exceptions to the ball player.
Yeah.
Rule, so.
Boy, you just can't help but want to go back and try that again, don't
yeah.
you? Yeah. Hey, how did you get so interested in all of this, Peter? What was a drawing card for you?
Well, for me, I think it really did begin with that radio call-in show in Chicago. Mm-hmm. I thought that it was unfair to the porters. And if I may say, it was a little bit ignorant, you know, to think that the porters were just these cardboard cutouts, sort of smiling Uncle Tom characters, because I think the truth is far different from that. Yeah, they did. Some of them played to racial stereotypes. That's how they gamed the system and got tips from passengers and whatnot. But, you know, there was also some of them refused to do that, to play that game.
Mm-hmm.
There was tremendous dignity in the nature of the work and in the way most of them went about doing it. And then when you add the legacy of the civil rights movement, I mean, you can only admire these men.
You know, there's all this talk about high-speed trains. Can you ever envision this era returning, you know, albeit in kind of a different form?
Yeah, I will certainly never go back to the Pullman Company and strictly African-Americans in service. This thing about the high-speed trains is that they are usually not overnight trains. You know, they'll go 200 or 300 miles and they'll whisk you there in an hour or two.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think we'll ever again see what we had back in the heyday of Pullman travel.
Well, Peter, I sure enjoyed having you. Thanks for sharing some great history of Pullman porters. It was great to visit with you.
Well, thank you, Steve. I enjoyed being here.
That's Peter Hansen. He's editor of Railroad History. This show originally aired in January. You'll find more information about our guests and our program at kcur.org. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. We had help today from KCUR's Kim Noble and Danny Alexander. Our senior producer is Steven Steigman. Let's go out this New Year's Eve with a tune by composer and jazz saxophone extraordinaire Bobby Watson, the man who also penned our show's theme music. This track is from his album Horizon Reassembled, and it's called Limoncello. Happy New Year, all. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.